Welcome to Equity. I'm Katie Roof, and I'm joined by my colleague, Matthew Lindley.
Hello.
And Crunchbase News Editor-in-Chief, Alex Wilhelm.
Hey, hey.
And our guest this week is Ethan Kurzweil from Bessemer Partners. Thank you for joining us, Ethan.
Hi, good to be here.
And so our first topic, we have some news, which Alex is really excited to tell us about.
It's true.
Uber Financials. They shared some of that data last week. Normally, it's just leaks
that
reporters like us get a hold of. But this time, they actually chose to share some of these numbers. So what are the numbers, Alex?
Okay, so this came via a disclosure, I think, to Bloomberg that we wrote about on the same day. And here are some of the top-level numbers that kind of buzzed around Silicon Valley. So Uber had gross bookings of $20 billion last year. They had $6.5 billion of net GAAP revenue last year, and they lost 5% more in the fourth quarter of 16 compared to the third. So they lost about $991 million in Q4 and $943 million in the third quarter. That worked out to a yearly loss of $2.8 billion on a non-GAAP basis. So that is not inclusive of Chinese losses and other things that don't often show up in non-GAAP numbers. So they want us to look at GAAP revenue, which has some issues given how they count Uber Pool, and non-GAAP losses. So they kind of want us to be nice to them, but we weren't, obviously. And so the summary here is that Uber still is growing very quickly, but it's not making a lot of progress to profitability on a raw dollar basis. So boo on that regard.
Was that surprised? Were you guys surprised? I mean, I think maybe out here we're used to the venture capital model where they spend on growth, and so they're not expected to be profitable, especially to keep up with the pace of growth that Uber has. But what did you think?
Well, I think the storyline they wanted you to take from this is that their rate of losses is decelerating, right? Is their revenue is going up faster than the losses increasing, and so their negative profit margin is better. It's less negative in Q4 than it was in Q3. So they're making progress on the business. And they also, the storyline I heard, which I think is totally false storyline to put out there, but what was sort of whispered was that all this negative publicity is not affecting them. Now, of course, those numbers are from Q4. A lot of the negative publicity is from Q1. So you'd have to go back and check in now to find out if there's been an impact. But I think it was, our business is healthy. Our losses are decreasing as a percentage. And like, we're not taking as much heat as we're taking in Silicon Valley. It's not as bad as you think because the rest of the world doesn't pay attention.
Well, is that more addition by subtraction from pulling out of China, do you think? Like, I mean, because that was a disaster, right? So it's like, of course we look better because we gave up on our worst business.
Right.
That is that helps. What AOL yeah, hasn't exactly. given up on so TechCrunch yet?
It was, they lost $2.8 billion last year, but it went up to $3.8 billion if you included China, and they did sell off their China business.
So that sweet Didi steak.
So, yeah, I think they were eager to share a positive story and help frame a positive narrative at a time where it has been anything but. But you're right, they did not share the first quarter financials. They said they had to review that with their investors first. But
and that's normal, right?
I mean,
you wouldn't expect them to be ready to reveal Q1 financials this early. But I think you're right about China. On the other hand, I think they were trying to paint a positive picture with respect to just the profitability of the business.
Right.
And depending on how bad you thought it was, maybe you felt like this isn't that bad. They're going to get to profitability, or maybe it was worse than you thought. But
it was a little worse than I thought. But I think on the narrative front, Katie had the most important contribution because she wrote the headline for the TechCrunch piece, and I was going to do something like Uber discloses financials or whatever. Katie came up with, and I quote, "Uber shares growing financials to distract from negative publicity," which was about as on the nose as a punch in the face. And I thought it was
obvious.
It was just freaking good.
What Uber story? Now does not mention the negative publicity, the controversies going on. You can't avoid it. It's everywhere.
And also, you know, a lot of people blame the media for this as if we're all the same. But actually, the Delete Uber campaign started on social media. And so we're just acknowledging what's already out there. There's a lot of negativity surrounding Uber and some of their controversial decisions that they've made. And so there's been a lot of chatter here in Silicon Valley for quite some time that the company has a very difficult work environment for a lot of different reasons. So I think just more of that has come to light, and more people outside of this region are becoming aware of that. And so we're just acknowledging what's already happening.
Well, I mean, it seemed more of like a mention of the mentioning of poor publicity for Uber more than anything else.
But I mean, showing off and trying to distract people from what's been, 3 to 4 months now of a steady drumbeat of negative stories. I mean, people in ride-sharing cars that I'm in, actually, you can't say you take Uber anymore in Silicon Valley because it's not woke. So
take a car. I took a car.
Lyft is woke. They said that in an interview.
Lyft is by definition woke because they declare it. But I mean, like, drivers will mention this to you. They say, hey, you've been tracking the stories about Uber. And I had a driver 2 days ago mentioned both Hell and Grayball to me, which were two controversial Uber programs. So to me, it's not just percolating around Silicon Valley, it's percolating down to the drivers, who are not, as you'd expect, you know, TechCrunch readers, because we're a smaller niche.
Sometimes they are, I ask.
yeah, there's some overlap there in Silicon Valley. But here's the question I'm dying to know, and maybe you guys can get a scoop on this, is how much is it really affecting their business outside of Silicon Valley? The Delete Uber campaign, all the negative publicity that you see everywhere you go about them, is that actually having an impact on, because it's a really, I think part of the reason for releasing is just showing you $20 billion, that's a lot of rides. Is the noise we all hear actually causing sort of a mass exodus, or it's a tiny blip in an otherwise sort of rosy picture towards a perfect company? I don't know.
Well, that's
clearly not a perfect company, but
the Delete Uber campaign caused him to step down from the Trump transition team. So there was a lot of people thinking that it did hurt their bottom line, because if it was just a temporary media story, he might have stayed and tried to influence the president. So I think that they were concerned about that. Obviously, we don't yet have access to this quarter's numbers, but I still think Uber is going to be a growing business, but it may hurt some of their growth, and they really, really need to keep up that pace if they want to justify their $68 billion valuation. So
it'll be really interesting to see what the magnitude was in terms of how much, because it probably did hurt their bottom line given how seriously they and how quickly they reacted. But the magnitude of it, it'll be really interesting. Was it massive and major, or again, like sort of noise at the fringes?
Oh, you mean like if it actually affected the baked-in goodwill to their valuation or something like that?
No, more just did it affect the number of rides and how much? You know, the Delete Uber campaign, presumably people are taking less Ubers as a result. How much less? Like what percentage did their ride or their growth get impacted by that?
Well, what do we have to work with then? So Travis basically said, I'm going to hire a COO or some kind of parental supervision. Lyft was able to raise at a pretty healthy valuation. So we had
7.9 billion?
Yeah, something like that. So we have all these like kind of perpendicular data points, right? So it's not entirely clear if they're going to be able to, hide that or whatever you want to call it.
Well, they've set the precedent now of releasing results. So hopefully they will continue and you'll be able to sort of draw the straight line and see where it changed, if at all.
Well, Brian Chesky, are you listening to this? You should be doing the same thing. So.
I'm in favor of just more information being out there. I mean, that's our business. We like to inform people. So I'm glad that Uber is clarifying some things. Although it was fun, I did at one point get a hold of Uber's financials. That was a couple years ago.
That was 2015.
Yeah. And I got their contribution margin, their performance in city by city. But obviously those numbers didn't tell the whole picture. So we've gotten different glimpses of their business. This gave us more of a picture, but there was still some stuff that was misleading. The Uber pool.
Yes, I'm glad we're going to talk about this. So tell us why that's tricky.
Okay, so they had some very misleading data about their revenue. Basically, they acknowledged it, but Uber Pool, they're accounting for all of that as revenue. That's their carpooling business. They're not saying that any of that goes to the driver, even though technically it does, but somehow they were able to get away with that with GAAP accounting principles. They were able to account for all of that as revenue right now, which...
Yeah.
The more Uber Pool becomes a growing part of their business, then the more their revenue is going to grow. But it's definitely misleading.
So on that point, here's something that drivers have told me that I wasn't aware of. So if you take an Uber Pool from SFO here to the city, you pay like about $25, right, roughly. And there's often three people in the car, so the ride generates about $75 in revenue. But the Uber Pool driver gets one of those plus $2 per drop-off and not the full 80% of the dollar amount per rider for each ride. So it could be that Uber takes a much larger effective take of the Uber Pool revenue, therefore making it fair on a GAAP basis to count the entire thing as revenue before it distros out to the drivers. But Ethan, talk to me.
Well, I actually think what they're trying to do is they're trying to just apply the GAAP principle here. I don't think their intent. It is. I think the effect of it is a little misleading. I don't think they're intending to be misleading in this case.
I agree with that.
I think what they're saying is, or what their accountants are saying, in fact, is we can't separate out on a per rider basis in a way that you would need so that you could just recognize Uber's cut. In this case, it's a bunch of revenue comes in and then they have some other formula that pays out the driver. So they have to recognize all the revenue, all the money that comes in as revenue, and then they have the cost, their cost of goods, which is what they paid the driver, as opposed to the other principle, which is we're just going to recognize as revenue the delta, the amount we keep of it. So I think it's probably an interpretation of GAAP that's different depending on the type of ride and not some attempt to be misleading. If they really wanted to unmask everything, they would separate them both out and they would say, here's gross receipts for the core business, here's gross receipts for the Uber pool business. Oh, and by the way, we're counting all of that of revenue because of this principle. And then here's what we pay drivers in each case, and here's the profitability of each one. But, you know, they sort of putting it all together makes it a little harder to track what's going on because you have a mix issue.
Yes.
But I don't think it's an intentional intent to be
And they disclose that. So they weren't deliberately misleading us. But yeah, one more question about Uber. Do you guys think they'll ever IPO or?
Well, I hope the next time they raise money, they have several hundreds of pages of information about their financials because that would make this a whole lot easier for us.
I feel like we're in the dark, in the closet, trying to like run around and not run into a wall. It's annoying. I want more actual data. I mean, because to Ethan's point, their bookings rose by 28% in Q4, but their GAAP revenue rose by 74%. I need more information to understand why that's the case. We have a general picture, but until I can see the actual contribution margins, I can't really vet how fast the profitability is really improving.
Well, and it could be a switch to Uber Pool, which would increase revenue because they take the higher number.
Exactly. But that's not enough to tell me how that impacts their actual operating margins. So I need just more numbers.
Well, Uber's not about to IPO anytime soon, according to their CEO. But one company is, and that's Cloudera. They're going public likely next week. And we have seen their financials now. And we also have seen the proposed range for pricing their IPO, which is very disappointing for companies like Intel that invested in it at a $4.1 billion valuation. And they're expecting their market cap to be less than half that. So, what do you guys think about that? And for those of you that don't know, Cloudera is a big data company. They use Hadoop.
Mm-hmm.
And they use Hadoop to help analyze this big data for companies.
That's the best enterprise tagline I've ever. They use Hadoop. And it does enterprise-y things.
They might steal that for their model.
Just so Katie Roofing quotes.
I'm trying to explain it, but you guys explain it better. They compete with Hortonworks, which already went public and is not doing very well. So that didn't help their valuation. And unfortunately for them, they raised funding at a time when Hortonworks had a better valuation. So this whole industry has taken a hit. But so what do you guys think about this?
Well, I mean, I'm actually wondering what kind of precedent this sets for companies that are built on open source software, right? What precedent does it set for Docker? What precedent does it set for these other guys, right? Because, you know, if you're looking at a company that's going public at half of its valuation, then obviously this is a big head scratcher for the investors that are looking at, you know, other potential companies that are starting to build their businesses off of open source software, right? And that's the backbone of a lot of technology in the Bay Area, right? It probably always will be, right? So it's, you know, can you build a real business off open source? I don't know. You know this probably way better than I do, Ethan.
Well, I have a somewhat contrarian view on this. I mean, $2.6 billion market cap coming out of the gates. That's still a... Can we swear on this podcast?
We cannot, yeah, and it's $1.79 billion.
Okay, so $1.8 billion is quite impressive market cap for, you know, a company coming right out of the gates. I mean, there are those that are more. And by the way, it's 4x, or at that valuation, it's about 3.5x Hortonworks's. So I still think it's a really successful company. I think they've shown a way to commercialize Hadoop in a way that is, you know, better than any other project out there. And their, you know, financial profile shows that the business actually works, not quite to the level that maybe some were expecting in pricing the Intel round, but it's by any reasonable standard a big, important company with a financial profile that means you're going to have staying power. So I still take the bullish view on open source software, and I think we're going to see a lot more IPOs at this level.
Well, so I mean, I'm also curious if this is just a general thing happening in Silicon Valley where the total addressable market that actually turns out just not to be as high as everyone thought it was, right? And, it, you know... It, obviously you have to make the call early on whether or not it's going to be a big enough TAM that it's worth, you know, $4 billion or whatever the case is, right? But are we just like overestimating something like this, especially in enterprise right now?
I think we're overestimating the costs. So I just pulled up their quarterly results from their S1, and in in their fourth quarter ending January 31st of this year, they had $73 million in revenue roughly, and just an operating loss of $61 million. So the expense required to build out this revenue that Ethan's properly describing is, I think, a lot higher than we anticipated as outside observers. I thought they were more capital efficient. Now, I agree they're a big business. I agree they have staying power. I agree that open source software is a great place to build a business, but the costs for enterprise sales right now are so high that the businesses that are currently operating in this space at the unicorn level are so deeply unprofitable, I think it throws into doubt their current health.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think they have two issues. One is the cost structure that you just pointed out. The other is perhaps the market, you know, the big data market as it relates to Hadoop is being disrupted by actually, as you know, surprise, surprise, by other open source software products that maybe do it in different ways that allow for, you know, different query structures, faster processing. There's all sorts of other projects out there that are making it so that Hadoop is no longer some gold standard for every particular type of data analysis you might want to do.
This has never happened before.
Right. So there may have been an over-enthusiasm as it related to Hadoop. I don't think it was as it related to open source software. And maybe the business is more expensive to run, but I'm not sure this is any sort of failure. It's just didn't achieve what maybe some thought.
Sure, and there's no question that this is a great success in the sense that they have built a company into a multi-billion dollar company in a short period of time, and that's usually the case with a lot of these down round IPOs. But I think it is important to note these change in valuations because, you know, it's not just investors that are losing money. It's employees that join the company at these times, and their shares are not worth as the amount that they thought they would be, and it really affects the whole ecosystem and valuations of companies, and also makes it harder for some companies to IPO when they're in this valuation trap. So I think we're going to be seeing more of these downround IPOs.
I hope people take note of pushing the valuation as high as they can for the exact downside you just expressed of options getting priced, expectations getting missed, even though it's still a success. And so that we may be seeing
Ethan
a lot
wants
more
to buy your company at a discount, I think.
You called me
no,
on
but
it.
But you know, it's true. We don't want to overvalue stuff.
Point, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to be overvalued.
It's a wonder we
bottom
didn't,
line.
We didn't learn from color at this point. So,
well, we'll get to a color-esque thing in just a minute. But it's time for an ad. So TechCrunch Disrupt is going back to New York this May 15th through the 17th. This is about the fifth, sixth time it's been in New York. I've been to a bunch of these. Anyways, this year, Derek Jeter, a kind of unknown shortstop from Miami.
He played for the Yankees.
I think Lindley may have an opinion about baseball. Anyways, he's going to be there to talk about his sports media startup called, apparently, Players Tribune. And on the other side of the nerd spectrum, Garry Kasparov is going to be around to talk about artificial intelligence.
And we also have a band that has a vague, haunting mass appeal. I apologize for that one, actually. Incubus will be joining us to perform along with Pharrell to show off their technology music startup, Mixed Halo, which is, I guess, fine.
There will also be some familiar faces from the finance world. Maha Ibrahim from Canaan Partners, she was on this podcast. She'll be there. And Naval Ravikant of AngelList will be there as well. We'll also be recording a special episode of Equity, so be sure to come and watch. Today's the last day to get the early bird discount on our site. Visit techcrunch.com/disruptny.
Please watch us.
Yeah, it's going to be really awkward if no one shows up.
Yeah,
okay, thanks,
yeah.
Bye.
That's going to be Alex's fault, though.
Okay, and so now we're
now
back
that that's
some
over
news.
With.
Hey, we did not.
Got some acquisitions this week, some big acquisitions. Actually, we had PetSmart acquired Chewy.com, which I don't have a dog, so I didn't even know about this, but it was the biggest e-commerce acquisition ever. It's $3.35 billion. Actually, my roommates have dogs, so I play with dogs. I just don't have to pay for anything
do
for
you,
dogs.
Wait, how big is PetSmart?
It's been private in 2014 or 15 for like 800 and something.
The valuation $8 billion, but yeah, that was a few years ago. And so yeah, this is a pretty big deal for a company of that size. I mean, it's really a big deal for a company of any size. It's technically slightly higher than the Jet acquisition that Walmart did a few years back. So
do you think they actually
and this is all according to Recode's reporting.
By $50,000.
So. Right, right. So they exactly. So it's $3.35 billion according to their reporting.
That was probably part of the terms, is like we still have to be higher than
those
Jet.
Those things matter in these negotiations. We want to be the highest. And so they were narrowly.
I mean, seriously though, this is like this is almost signals like, okay, we're going to do something perpendicular to what we do, or we're going to do something that's going to be like, we think is going to be wildly additive to our current business, to the point that we're going to bet, you know, the future potentially on this deal, right? I mean,
and for a private equity firm, it's not a big market cap company with, you know, $100 billion of cash that can, you know, $3 billion is not a lot to. This is their, they've penciled out this acquisition in terms of their return profile and think it's going to make sense. So, or it's just a wild risk for them to take. But I think it shows, you know, e-commerce is real and that they were able to build a brand in this sort of quiet, sleepy way that has all the characteristics of a multi-billion dollar company. Yeah. That's pretty impressive.
I think
actually.
They're in Florida, right?
Yeah, they are in Florida. And that's part of the reason it seems quiet out here, because we tend to follow a lot of the Silicon Valley companies or even some of the New York and LA companies. But Florida is a little bit under the radar. But the founder was involved with Blue Nile before and Zulily. So he had e-commerce experience. And so I think this is an interesting bet. I think we're going to be seeing more of these non-traditional acquirers, as they're calling it, companies that are not necessarily associated with tech or startups buying other companies in that are. And so we saw Dollar Shave Club getting acquired by Unilever. There have been a lot of other companies that have been rumored to sell to them. Walmart has been acquiring not just Jet, but some smaller startups as well. So I think there's a lot happening in this space.
Well, what's interesting here is that the $3.35 billion number sounds very impressive, but they did almost $900 million in revenue last year. So it's like a 3.8x sales multiple. So it's a really great exit for everyone involved with the company, but it's not like 100x revenue. They're buying a serious, substantial current business. And that's why I think Ethan's point about long-term cash flows makes a lot of sense.
I mean, I'm just curious also because, you know, part of the reason why the Dollar Shave Club deal, and sorry to keep beating this dead horse over and over and over again, part of the reason why the Dollar Shave Club deal was so interesting and so large was because they own the customer relationship, right? And, you know, where does Chewy sit on something like that? You know, do you think that, you know, do they look more like an Honest Company? Or do you think they look more like a Dollar Shave Club? And like which way is this bet going?
Probably more like a Dollar Shave Club in that they own the customer relationship. But I think they're selling other people's products in that case. But they must have built in order to get that kind of, because that's actually a high sales multiple for e-commerce.
Sorry.
A lot of times it's, you know, 1 to 2x revenue. They must have been a very profitable company, and probably the only way to do that is to build a brand where, and I don't think a lot has come out about their, you know, gross margins and contribution margins and all of that, but they must have built a brand without a ton of advertising to be able to get to the point where they could be, you know, worth, you know, billions of dollars on $900 million in revenue.
They're actually not profitable, according to something I read in Recode again, but they had the scoop here, so I'm giving them credit. But yeah, so it is a little bit surprising from that perspective, but they're sort of like a Jet for dogs. That's my understanding, is they have low prices, they're low margin, high volume business. So, or maybe a future Amazon for dogs.
I think what matters, so I didn't know that point out that they weren't profitable, but I think what probably matters is what the customer lifetime value was looking like, and were they trending towards profitability on the way they were acquiring customers.
Yeah,
so a lot of companies like SaaS companies grow unprofitably for a long time, but it makes sense because they then turn the corner because customers keep coming back and back and they don't have to spend more to get them.
Like Amazon, which did that forever. Yeah.
Which is still doing it in some cases.
If we're not hearing about it, then it seems, you know, maybe the customer acquisition cost is, you know, negligible, right? If it's all word of mouth, then you're, you know, you can turn that into like an extremely efficient business, even if you're a retail company.
And you're going to be unprofitable as you scale an e-commerce operation, have to set up warehouses and things like that. So I got to imagine, you know, a private equity buyer would have, you know, wouldn't have been fooled by that kind of thing.
And there was another acquisition this week, Moat, which is an ad tech company that helps advertisers monitor how well their ads are doing online. They were acquired for apparently $850 million also by Recode. They were acquired by Oracle, which has, you know, pretty large market cap, like $180 billion. So they can easily afford this kind of company. But it's good to see some more ad tech deals. Last year, we broke the story that AppLovin was acquired for over $1 billion, almost $1.5 billion from a Chinese company. And so for a little while, a few years ago, investors were investing a lot in ad tech. And then people were down for a little while because there weren't as many exits, but we're starting to see a lot more. So that should be interesting. And so, but for our last topic, let's do something fun. We have Juicero. Had some crazy news this week, or it was just really a crazy video that Bloomberg did, which for those of you who don't know, that's that fancy machine that used to be like $700. Now it's $400. It squeezes juice. And apparently you can squeeze it.
I mean, I can't even let you get past that. It's like, it's a 700, 400. It's too much. And it makes waterly juice. Like, I mean, come on, people.
Has anyone tried the juice?
I've tried the juice. It's good. It's good. Yeah. I like juice. I like juice, and so I'm in favor of innovation in the juice space. However, I cannot afford a $400 juice machine. If I could, I would buy it. That said, I wouldn't invest in this if I were an investor. But I do see their vision here. If you look at all the juice shops around San Francisco, New York, and LA, there's a market opportunity to be more efficient with
juicing. In three cities. You just three cities where that works.
It's not, right. I think they may have overestimated the market opportunity, but there is a market opportunity there. And if they do make it more efficient and more affordable over time, their product is not there yet.
Guys, we haven't even gotten to the best part of why we're talking about Juicero. Lindley, can you explain to me the glorious thing that Bloomberg uncovered?
That basically you can literally squeeze the bag with your hands and get the juice out.
And not have to spend, how much money was it on a juicer?
$400. So,
and everyone comes equipped with two hands when they're born. So you have built-in Juiceros right here.
Yes, and that is why I would not pay for the machine, aside from not having the money. But on top of that, but I did tweet about this, and the Juicero owner got back to me that no matter that he's still going to use the machine because he doesn't want to spend 2 minutes of his morning squeezing out juice. And I would feel the same way, to be honest. If I had one of those machines, I would rather put it in the machine and go brush my teeth. Not that you should drink orange juice after brushing your teeth, but you know, you could go be productive for 2 minutes rather than just standing there for 2 minutes squeezing the juice.
What if it's a workout, though?
Yeah.
I mean, her knuckles are turning white in the video. But
I don't think
that this is a good price point for their product, and I don't think it's that great of a machine.
Here's my question about the company as a sort of dispassionate investor just looking at it. Is this some sort of winner-take-all situation or some kind of, even if you buy the juice trend, which is probably buyable, right, if you look at the number of juice shops popping up in the locations that they are, but aren't there a lot of paths to the truth here in terms of juice? Paths to the juice that didn't quite work?
No, that's lovely.
I don't quite get why there's sort of one gold standard here. There are juicers that are out there. You can use your hands, as somebody pointed out, but that's not even the problem in my book. Like, there's just, I can't imagine a juice monopoly. It just doesn't make sense.
I mean, Jamba Juice.
You know, you can go to the smoothie place, you can use a blender, you can get some exercise. So I'm missing the unique insight that this company had. That said, like, a lot of people like it, and they designed something maybe that was pretty cool. And so, you know,
it only raised
marketplace will decide.
Yeah, I mean, it only raised $118.5 million. We didn't really, as an industry, put a lot of money into it. Not at all. No, it's only nine figures of capital.
Right.
That's my question. I mean, it could be a great product, but that implies that folks see some sort of monopoly-like position, and it's hard to see that.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to justify investing that kind of money in it. But if I were to inherit a free Juicero, I would use it.
Can we just get one for the TechCrunch office?
I actually use Postmates to get juices sent to me sometimes. Not very often, because I feel guilty about being privileged.
If you pulled your money on that, yeah, exactly. The Juicero.
Just don't do that for a month and then buy two.
I don't do it all the time. Occasionally I do that.
I love you confess that unprompted. Like, just like, here's some of my dirty laundry right here on the show.
Well, you know, some juices are good. I don't know. It's not a bad thing. But I think we're out of time, so thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, everyone. We want to say a special thanks to our producer, TechCrunch's own Christopher Gates, our executive producer, Henry Picavet. Thank you to Katie Roof. Thank you to Matthew Lindley. And thank you to you for leaving us that 5-star iTunes review. That's Equity. We'll see you all next Friday.